Good morning. So last time we covered minimum spanning tree algorithms, and we had two algorithms, and both were greedy. We did something where we got a list of candidate edges, and we chose the least cost among them, lowest weight. And we never took back that decision. Once we added that to our answer, that was part of our answer, we never found some cheaper edge later on that, you know, we could replace a couple edges with. No taking back. This was unlike what we had to do for, say, Traveling Salesman, where we like tried everything, and even if we were doing some ordering, we might find some better way of doing it later on. So the two ways were prims and crustacles. And the difference was that with prims, we tracked the vertices we actually used, and our candidate edges were only edges which would add a new vertex. Which would connect a vertex that wasn't connected to where we started yet. And with crustacles, we didn't care about the vertices as far as which ones were connected yet. We just said our candidate edges are everything that doesn't create a cycle. We know a cycle means we don't have a tree anymore, so we're going to add every edge we can that won't make it not be a tree anymore. And with Prim's algorithm, we tracked the vertices with a priority queue, and this basically tracked the edges that were currently candidates. The edges were a candidate if they were the best edge to connect a particular new vertex, and using the priority queue, we selected among the ones we've discovered so far, the least cost one. When we added an edge, then we had these new candidate edges, which were the ones that connected vertices through through using the edge we just added. So we looked at where the vertex that edge connected, looked at all the edges out of there, and saw if we had any new vertices that we could connect. And we looked at those edges and potentially updated our priority queue to say, oh, I have a better way to get to this vertex, and so I might use that edge. With crustacles, we sorted our edges. We just did normal sort. We're going to process them in order. And we needed to do this operation where we tracked whether there were cycles. And we said that we had a naive way of doing this, where we just, you know, every time we look at an edge, we just create the graph where we have that edge added, and then we do some sort of graph traversal. One example would be a breadth first search, and we see if we find any backwards paths. So with a breadth first search, you see if you ever visit a node twice. You find an edge that goes to a node you already visited. If you do, it's not a tree, it has a cycle. You know, the cycle includes that edge and whatever path you get back to where you found it. So we could do that, but that would be really slow. We do like look over potentially most of the graph each time we add an edge. So we wanted this better idea of a set tracking data structure. I told you that it turns out that there's this really efficient and pretty simple to implement set tracking data structure, where, like several data structures we've seen, the hard part is really, well, several algorithms we've seen, the hard part is really showing that it works efficiently. So like with prim and crustacles, the hard part is showing that it's correct. And with this, the hard part isn't showing that it's correct, but that it's actually fast. And it turns out it's really fast. Fast enough that our runtime is basically dominated by the sort of the vertices. Okay, so any questions about these topics before I move on? So I'm going to finish up explaining what that union find data structure looks like. And I'll talk about one miscellaneous topic that connects minimum spanning trees and traveling salesmen. And then we'll move on to our next big subject, our final big subject. So questions about, I'll stop. Okay, so when I was talking about implementing union find, you know, that data structure that would track the sets we were in for the purpose of determining whether we had cycles. The idea I told you about was that we would have our sets have these IDs, which were a vertex. So we would look at the set of a vertex, and we'd identify each set by a representative vertex. So for each set, we just choose arbitrarily some vertex in it that was a set. And for each item in a potentially in a set, we'd have this parent of pointer. So we point to each vertex would point to another vertex saying, I'm in the same set as this other vertex. And we'd identify the representative of the set by a vertex which pointed to itself. So it points to itself, it's the representative, it's the one that we give the ID for, otherwise we have to keep going until we find that self-pointer. And our union operation just sets this pointer, we set one representative to point to the other, and that updates everything that's part of that set, because we're gonna, when we do our find operation, we're gonna traverse those parent pointers until we find that loop. And since we made one point to another, it's not gonna be there. It's gonna be in the combined set. So this is probably better explained with a picture. So here I have two sets. I have this set FG, and its representative is F. So if I ask what set is G in, I'm gonna say, okay, G's parent is F, and F's parent is F, so it's in set ID F. If I ask what set C's in, C's parent is D, D's parent is A, A's parent is A, so it's in set ID A. And similarly, if I ask, okay, what set B's in, B's in set A. This is not the graph we're, you know, doing minimum spanning tree on. This is the representing the parent pointers that we're using to track the sets. So when we do our union operation, for example, let's say we're doing Kreskal's algorithm, and in Kreskal's algorithm, we have this edge from D to G. So we're gonna say, I want to combine the set that D is in with the set that G is in. So we find out that D is represented by A, and G is represented by F. So we add an edge from one representative to the other, replacing that loop. So now, if I ask what set is D in, I'm gonna say, okay, D is in the same set as A is in the same set as F, F's in the same set as F is the representative of this set. So this algorithm has the advantage that I just changed one pointer to do the union operation. So the union operation was fairly simple. It made my future find operations potentially take a lot longer, but at least I didn't have to iterate through all the vertexes in set A, B, C, D to do this. I just set one pointer. No questions about this procedure? I guess I should. So, and the trick is that this here means that parent of A equals F. So this is a working way to implement that set tracking data structure, and it's, you know, conceptually not that much code. Like, this is basically the code. Like, there's a few details of, like, what does that map actually look like? It's probably like a hash table or something, or maybe I add something to my vertex data structure, but it's actually not that much code. But you might say, well, is this really fast? So because one complaint you would have is that, well, I did this union operation, and now let's say there was an edge from C to E, and I wanted to do that union operation. Now to find what set C is in, I need to look at C is in the same set as D, A, and F, and that's a pretty long chain. And you might worry, and legitimately, that, well, maybe that chain could get really, really long. Maybe every time I'm looking at an edge, I could end up traversing through these parent pointers through essentially all my vertices. And that would make my Kreskal's algorithm, now, you know, every time I look at an edge, I need to like do some operation for every vertex. So I have this extra E times V factor in my Kreskal's runtime, which would be really bad. Make it much, much worse than prims. And we know that doesn't happen, but with this data structure, we can construct cases where we, you know, if the edges have the weight such that we evaluate them in the right order, that would happen. But there are a few little changes we can make, little optimizations to this basic idea of these parent pointers to get rid of that problem. And there are different choices for this, so I'm gonna go over one. So one of them is something called path compression. And basically you can think of this as saying, well, when I find out that, you know, D is representative as A, I'm just gonna store that information for later. So what I'm saying here, for example, is let's say I ask, hey, what set is C in? Well, when I do that, I'm just going to add a new edge here, replacing this set, replacing the one from C to D. I'm just gonna say, okay, it's in set A, or we should say, when I do it here, I'm gonna, you know, when I ask what set C's in, I'm gonna add that edge. If I ask what set it's in here, I'm gonna add that edge. I'm just going to cache the information by just making my parent pointers be flatter, just point directly to the representative I know right now. So this is sometimes called path compression. I'm, you know, instead of having my path go CDA, I'm just making it go CDAF. I'm just making it go C to F directly. And I just do that every time you ask me, hey, what sets C in or what sets G in? I just do that operation of updating those pointers to take that shortcut. So this is just shortcutting future searches for that loop vertex. So that's one thing to optimize the performance. And independently of that, there's another thing to do, and that's be careful about where I choose my parent pointers. So an observation you might make here is that, well, it would really have been better if I made F point to A. And one intuition for that you can have is that, well, the set A is in, that's a much bigger set, so I want to point to it because, you know, it's gonna have longer paths. And by making it point somewhere else, I'm making those longer paths even longer. So a way of implementing that is you can track the size of every set. This doesn't require us to like traverse all the parent pointers. We just track it as we do union operations. We just add up the sizes of the two sets. And we can use that to decide which direction we set the pointer. So in this case, we wouldn't do this. We wouldn't make A point to F, we'd make F point to A because the set F it was in was small. And this is another thing that's gonna keep us from getting these really long chains like CDAF. And the non-obvious thing is that very good runtime I told you about, that inverse Ackermann function, almost like better than log n time, comes when you do these two optimizations to the data structure. Like, that's not something we're gonna prove, it's something you can learn how to prove in an algorithms class. But this is the data structure you implement, and it turns out when you do that, it has really good runtime. So any questions about union find? Okay. So for my last topic about graphs, I'm gonna talk about a connection between minimum spanning tree and traveling salesman. This is something which is not in Florian's slides, so we won't be testing it, though it might be helpful in the post lab. So I assume you won't mind me talking about it. So we're going to talk about a special case for the traveling salesman. And this is a common thing you'll see done when people talking about solving traveling salesmen is that, well, general traveling salesman is actually a lot harder than these special cases. And one special case we're going to have is that we're going to assume that the weight going from A to B is less than if we go from A to B through some other vertex C. So this is something you'd expect to be true if my weights were set by, say, distances, right? If I tell you, you know, it's 100 miles from one city to another, you don't expect me to say, oh, but it's 30 miles to go to some other city and then another 30 miles to go from that city to that other city that was originally 100 away. You don't expect that to happen. You expect me, you know, not to set up routes that way. So in this special case, we're going to come up with a good solution, and we can actually show that this is a particular kind of good. So we're going to find a minimum spanning tree. So let's say this is the graph we're doing our traveling salesman on, and this is our minimum spanning tree. So you find a minimum spanning tree, and we do a pre-order traversal of the tree, or any traversal of the tree, and we use that as a tour. So here's my pre-order traversal, and I just use that as my tour. So I visit A, then I visit its first child, its visit B, then D, then its children, then visit C, and so on. That's my traversal. So that's certainly a valid traveling salesman tour. But the interesting thing is that we can show it's a certain kind of good, that if this triangle rule holds, we can show that it's within a certain factor of the optimal tour. So this is not, probably, almost certainly not going to be the optimal tour, which may, but we can show that it's close in some sense to the optimal tour. So one observation is that the worst weight of this tour is going to be twice the weight of the minimum spanning tree. And the way you can figure that out is, let's say that these blue arrows are my tour on this simple three-node minimum spanning tree. When I go from B to C, that's the same as going through the tree through A. And by the triangle rule, that's, you know, that's not going to be, you know, that the path from B to C is not going to be longer than that. So if I consider the weight of going back through these edges to traverse from B to C, you know, it's as bad as if I used every edge in the minimum spanning tree twice. So in the example here, when I'm going from C to E, it's like the edges I'm covering as I'm going down this edge, going down this edge, I'm going back up this edge, down this edge, back up this edge, back up this edge, down this edge, and back up. So I can find a path on my tour through the minimum spanning tree. And that path uses every edge in the minimum spanning tree exactly twice. And because of the triangle rule, we know that that path is going to be, you know, a bound on the cost of the actual tour. Like the actual tour, when we can take the shortcut directly from C to E, is going to be shorter. So we need that rule to know that it's actually shorter and not somehow longer. But given that, the cost of this, the tour is going to be no worse than twice the weight of the minimum spanning tree, because we just can, you know, get that tour by visiting every edge twice. We can come up with that weight. And there's this other observation we can make, which is that the traveling salesperson tour, if we take that tour and we remove one edge, it's a spanning tree. It's a tree, it doesn't have any cycles when we remove an edge, and it visits every single node. It's not a very tree-ish tree, it's a linked list, degenerate case of a tree, but it's still a tree. And it's a spanning tree because it covers every vertex. So this tells us that the Minimum spanning tree is, that is in the wrong direction, isn't it? The minimum spanning tree is, is less than the best TSP solution. Because we know that if we take the TSP solution and subtract something from it, because this is the best TSP solution is less than some spanning tree plus, equals some spanning tree plus one edge. Because we know the weight of the TSP is more than the weight of some spanning tree, strictly more. And this tells us that, therefore, since this weight is, no more than twice as bad as the best tour. So even though we did this sort of very naive thing where you just said, we're going to take our spanning tree and just follow the path, traverse it like a tree and use that as our tour, and we're just going to take shortcuts where, conceptually we're going through the tree, but when we make our traveling salesman tour, we're just going to take a shortcut and not actually visit every edge twice. It ends up being that this is within 2x as bad as the best tour. So this is not a way to find the best traveling salesperson solution, but it is a way to find a very, very quick bound on the best one. Again, assuming we can have this triangle rule, assuming my distances follow the sort of normal property we expect distances on the map to follow. So to give an example of that, so here I have a graph with edges in gray, which are actually invisible on that screen. But here I have, say, a minimum spanning tree, and let's assume this was a fully connected graph. And this is my minimum spanning tree, and my distances in this case are going to be just, Euclidean distance on the edge. So I just choose a route for my tree, and let's say F, and I choose a preorder traversal. So I visit F, then B, then E, then A, then the next tile G, then D, then C. That's my preorder traversal, and I just go directly there. And I have some edges here which aren't in my tree, but I know that they're no worse than if I took a path through the tree. So in the case of getting from A to G, I know that I could have gone A, E, B, F, G, and that the path I'm taking is better than that. So, I know that my tour is no worse than the total weight of all those that indirect way through the tree. And similarly, for getting from D to C, I could go through G, and from C to F, I could go through G. And I know the weight of those blue edges is no worse than taking that path through my minimum spanning tree. So, any questions about this topic? So, minimum spanning tree approximation. Okay. So, as I said, hopefully that sort of brief introduction will help you on the post-lab at least, even if you aren't interested in it just intellectually. So our next topic is some things about memory. So first, let's talk about memory layouts. So this is what a typical program's memory layout looks like on Linux. And you've kind of seen this maybe in the debugger. You see addresses of pointers, and they have like particular numbers. And generally, sort of a common thing to do on Linux, you know, that's chosen is that we have the stack at this address up here. We have our code at some fixed address down here, followed by writable data, which is global variables mostly. You know, like cout, for example, would be in there. Followed by heap and other dynamic data. So this is like operator new and so on. So we're going to talk a little about, you know, memory allocation. So we have our heap. And the convention on Unix and many other systems, and at least on x86, is that this heap, so it's near the bottom of the address space. So here I'm showing it to you right after our global variables and things which were, you know, exist when the program starts. So this is sort of these, you know, loaded from executable. Just above the stuff which is loaded from the executable, and it goes upwards, as in upwards, which equals towards greater addresses. And we also have our stack, which is where we allocate local variables and handle function calls, and it grows downwards, which equals towards lesser addresses. So these grow towards each other, and hopefully they never meet. And in practice, the operating system does a little extra work to make sure that if you try to grow the stack or heap too much, you probably, hopefully, get a seg fault rather than mysteriously overwriting things you knew by calling a function. And we have these two very different policies for these two regions of memory. So the stack is basically compiler managed. You never do anything to say, this is on the stack. You just make a local variable, and the compiler figures out where to put it. And usually the compiler's decision tree is, can I fit this in a register? If so, let's use a register. Otherwise, I'm going to put it on the stack. And you similarly never need to worry about getting rid of variables on the stack. They just go away. And the compiler takes care of that for you, typically by adjusting the stack pointer when they're deallocated, which happens implicitly when they go out of scope. You have them in some scope, i.e. between some pair of braces, basically. And when that your code exits that pair of braces in any way, like through returning or like through an exception, the variable goes away. And this means that generally things on the stack, you can only use in a particular procedure, and it grew, and so on. With the heap, it's all programmer managed. So it's programmer managed, you used new, you had a lab where you used malloc a little bit, but there are these functions or operators you call where you say, I want some memory. You have to ask for it explicitly. Or some library you're using has to ask for explicitly, like use vector. Vector uses the heap. It's calling new itself on your behalf. And this means that you also need to explicitly get rid of it. It doesn't go away for you implicitly. This is helpful because it means it outlives procedures. It's not so helpful because it means that, well, if you forget to do that explicit free, you're wasting memory. So something worth talking about with this picture is that these addresses look awfully convenient, and one thing I have on this picture is I'm telling you that on Linux we're going to just start our code at address 40000hex for every single program. So how is that possible? And there's This mechanism we're going to have in our processor, which you'll learn more about when you take computer architecture, where we have program addresses, that program accesses, and there's this mapping in the processor set by the operating system to real addresses. So the addresses you see in your program are not actually the memory addresses that your RAM chips expect. Instead, they're addresses that correspond to the input to this mapping set by your operating system. So the operating system decides where the stack and the heap actually are, and therefore it also decides how much of the stack and heap are valid. So if you have memory in here, and this gap between the stack and the heap, well, the operating system doesn't actually need to allocate all that memory for you to actually use. It just leaves that part of the mapping blank until you need it. And we sometimes see the name virtual for program addresses and physical for the addresses that are in the underlying real machine that only the OS can deal with. And generally on any OS you've used, you always access memory using only virtual addresses. You never get a chance to use physical addresses directly except on what you probably consider old machines. So we're going to talk a little bit about memory allocation APIs. So I'd like to talk about two types. So one is VoidStar. So VoidStar is the generic pointer type. It's generic, so you can't dereference it because we don't know what type it references. It's conceptually a pointer to void. Void isn't a real thing, but you can use it to just pass around a pointer. I don't know what kind of pointer it is. In C, void is special. You do not need casts in C to convert from a void pointer to another type of pointer. You can just assign it, and it works. In C++, you need casts. Another type that we're going to see is size T. So size T is an unsigned integer type, which is big enough to hold the size of anything allocated. We have this type def because, like on a 32-bit system, it might vary, like what size this is, whether this is something that fits in an int or not. So we have this type def just so we know what the type is. On x86, 64, it's the same as an unsigned long, typically. But this might vary between other architectures. And when we have a memory allocation function, it will usually take a size T instead of like an int or a long. So no matter what system we're using, we can pass in the size we want to allocate. So you saw our stack and heap here. And I told you, well, the stack is compiler managed. There's no like allocation functions, and that's, well, not entirely true. There's a non-standard allocation function that is commonly implemented called alloca. And it allocates space in the stack frame of the caller, which is automatically freed when the function that called alloca returns to its caller. Now this is a really weird function that in fact exists on Linux and several other systems. So it's kind of like malloc, but it allocates space on the stack. Since it's space on the stack, it goes away when your function returns. So a good question you might have is, how could you possibly write this function? We're allocating space. There's like a return address on the stack we don't want to overwrite. There's potentially a bunch of other stuff. What do you do? how can you do this? You don't know like how the calling function used the stack. So let's say, what does this function actually look like? So fortunately, I found a nice old implementation, and it's pretty short. So this is from 3D6 BSD, which is a 1990 operating system. I chose this one because it's x86, and it's probably the oldest x86 implementation of Alloc I could find. So this is 32-bit x86, that's why we're not using RDX or RDI. A note on 32-bit x86 is that the calling convention is that arguments are on the stack. All arguments are on the stack. There's no arguments passed through registers here, which is just the typical 32-bit x86 calling convention. So what this function does is, well, we figure, it gets rid of the return address, so it can get to the arguments. It gets the amount to allocate. And then it just adjusts the stack pointer. Okay, that's straightforward enough. But now we have to return somehow. And also, our calling function saved a bunch of stuff, probably, to the stack. So and we have to actually have our calling function be able to access things. So the big assumption we're making is that on this system, the convention was that a base pointer was always used. So if you remember RBP and RSP, that idea of save a base pointer to where we were at the beginning of the function, that's the convention here. So because that's being used, we know that local variable accesses use that base pointer. And that's why our caller can still access local variables on the stack. And this is a reason why you would use a base pointer to support things like Alloc. So that answers the question of, well, how do we allocate space without disrupting all the local variables? The way we did it is that we're adjusting the stack pointer, we're not adjusting the base pointer in our calling function. So this seems like a problem for modern systems because, as we told you, typically on x86-64, we don't use base pointers. And they're optional. But apparently on this system, they weren't. And there's another probably more dangerous looking assumption here, in that we have to worry about, what if you save some registers to call this function? You save some registers on the stack, you pushed a bunch of stuff on the stack and you're gonna pop it. How do we make that pop work when we just adjusted the stack pointer to allocate more space? The solution this implementation of Alloc has is, we assume you saved at most three things, and we just copy the top three things on the stack to the new stack pointer. And, well, there's no reason why we can assume saving three things works. I'm guessing they just like wrote the compiler so they knew, but like, there's no actual reason to think that this always works. So this is an old implementation of Alloc, and it seems really sketchy. It seems like, well, we're depending on this base pointer idea, which you've seen, we don't see compilers using much anymore, especially with optimizations on, because it wastes a whole register. And we're also kind of making this assumption on exactly how our caller saves things and exactly how much stuff our caller saves, which seems a little unwarranted. So this function still exists and it's not implemented in this way. The typical modern implementation is that it's a compiler built in. So here I have a function where I call Alloc. And I'm just calling a function bar to make sure I use the result. And if I use this with a modern compiler, it decides, okay, I'm going to use a frame pointer because I know you're calling Alloc in this function. Like, it just has a rule that Alloca is not a normal function. It's actually this compiler built in. And this is the typical way you see it implemented today. So this is really compiler built in. And part of the compiler built in implementation is it marks the function calling it as you must use a frame pointer because we're adjusting the stack pointer dynamically. And then the compiler implements the code to make RSP become RSP plus n or minus n, because I know which direction the stack grows. And to do allocate that space.
Is n the number of bits?
N, what is, the question is what units are n? N is a number of bytes. All the allocation functions we'll see today are going to take a number of bytes as their argument. We won't take a number of bits because, well, we have no way of addressing individual bits, let alone allocating individual bits. And generally, you'll see that our allocation functions are going to do a bit of rounding. So here, we round up to the next, this n to the next multiple of 16, basically. Because we just decide that we don't want to deal with having the stack pointer not be a multiple of 16. There's actually a rule in the calling convention saying you can't do that. Okay, so that's Alloca. I do not recommend using Alloca, but it exists. And it's probably a mistake because, you know, people thought that this implementation was a good idea at some point. Yeah?
Why would Alloca be used when in general objects are already stored on the stack with the same scope that Alloca
is? So the question is, why would you use Alloca when you could just allocate a local variable? The reason is that historically, and commonly today, this doesn't work. This is often an error, and was always an error in the days Alloca was popular. So I guess you may have used that feature in, so first of all, that I believe that still does not exist in C++. And variable length arrays are a feature that was added in the 1999 revision of C, but not implemented by many compilers, because they have some, many details of them are not things that compilers liked, really. I think they were removed from a later version of the CE standard, in fact, because they were so disliked, or made optional. So that's allocating space on the stack dynamically. So let's talk about allocating space on the heap. And you've seen this malloc function, takes size and bytes, and returns a pointer. And our typical usage is that we, you know, if we want to allocate an array, we compute the number of bytes in the array, allocate that. We can use this trick of the size of the thing that this array points to, or you can just say size of int, same thing. Want to allocate an item, we can allocate space. And as I said before, this is returns void star. In C, there's no cast needed. In C++, you need a cast. And going along with malloc, we have free, which basically undoes what malloc does. So malloc and free are the C, the low-level version of what, you know, what we've seen with new and delete. But there's a big difference between what malloc and free do and new and delete do. New does two things. New allocates memory and calls constructors. And you can actually do these things separately in C++. So there's a version of operator new. There's a function operator new size t that you can call directly, which allocates space. And there's a special syntax for calling constructors. You would think that it would be, you know, something like some pointer, you know, foo args, but it is not. That is not the syntax. I know you would hope it would be, but it's not. Instead, the syntax for calling constructors directly is this thing called placement new, where we say, I want to create a new object at location some pointer. And you pass the location in these parentheses, and then you do your rest of your call to new. So you can manually do what new does with these two steps. And when you write new foo 1, 2, 3, it's compiling into these two separate steps. First, allocating space by calling this version of operator new, which takes a size, and then calling the constructor on that newly allocated space. Questions about this? And this comes up sometimes when you're, say, implementing something like vector. So if you're implementing vector, you want to allocate space. You have an array of items, and you want to allocate them when you like push one back. So what a typical implementation of vector will do is do something like placement new to call the copy constructor in place in that array. Which is how you can not call operator new and have this array that you change the size of and still have the copy constructor be called when you copy into it. Okay. So this is new. New does these two things. And delete similarly does two things. It calls destructors, which you can do manually in this case. What you'd actually expect, you can actually just call the constructor like a method, just its name starts with a tilde. And then it actually frees memory. So this means our same implementation of vector, if we're doing popback, for example, we want to destroy the thing we just popped off the vector, so it's going to call the destructor, because it's going to deallocate the memory in some other way. So that's where you might do, you know, one of the steps manually if you're allocating memory differently. But when you call delete, the compiler, you know, delete foo just does both of these things for you. Okay. So questions about new and delete? Yes. So the question is, what does actually freeing the memory mean? So next time we'll talk about implementing malloc and free, and I will get more to this. So this is basically sort of like, it's not quite the same, like free foo. Just like if we think of the operator new with the size as malloc foo. And this says, make the memory available to be used by new. So it just says, marks the memory as new can use this memory again, basically.
What about the actual stuff that is stored in the memory?
So in a typical implementation, most of the time it's just going to say, mark this memory as new can use it again, and it won't be changed until new does. But in occasionally, it's going to be the case that it says, oh, I have all this free memory, I should give some of it back to the operating system. So in that case, the memory won't be modified, but the operating system might decide that, oh, you have this mapping here, I'm just going to remove part of that mapping because you freed up enough memory. In which case, it's not going to be the case that, like, it's not going to overwrite what's there, it's going to be if you try to access it, now it's a segfault. So next time we'll talk about a little about implementing malloc, and then about caches and strings.